This is Free Thought Radio with co-hosts Dan Barker and Annie Laurie Gaylor. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Gaylor, and welcome to Free Thought Radio on this Memorial Weekend. And let's remember all Americans who have defended our nation, including the non-believers who are memorialized on FFRF's Atheist in Foxhole Monument in Alabama that is dedicated to the freethinkers who are vets and in the military who we hope are working for a world where war will become unnecessary.
And I'm Dan Barker, your friendly neighborhood atheist of the airwaves. This is the May 24th, 2014 broadcast of Free Thought Radio. This show is produced in Madison, Wisconsin. After we broadcast on Saturday mornings here in Madison, then we also broadcast in California on stations in New York, in Michigan, other parts of the country, including Missouri and Texas. Or you can sign up for the podcast at our webpage at ffrf.org.
Free Thought Radio is the weekly production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, which is the nation's largest association of atheists and agnostics, and we work to keep religion out of government, and we hope you'll join us not someday, but soon at ffrf.org.
And our Alabama chapter will be having a glorious 4th of July celebration in the first weekend of July, July 3rd through the 5th, that you might want to come to. Annie Laurie and I will both be there. Today, we have two guests on our show. In the second half of today's show, we're going to talk with the biographer, Megan Marshall, whose book, Margaret Fuller, A New American Life, just won the 2014 Pulitzer Prize in Biography.
And Margaret Fuller was definitely a free thinker, a 19th century deist and feminist ahead of her time. And by the way, Megan Marshall referred to the guest that we're about to introduce on the first half of our segment today as the Margaret Fuller of today in her brilliance. But I'll let Dan tell you who our guest will be.
Well, we're happy to have back on Free Thought Radio Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein on the phone from the Boston area. She's the author. Listeners to this show know all about Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein. She's the author, philosopher. She has a brand new book out, which is called Plato and the Googleplex, a fun book, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. She teaches philosophy of mind, of science, of psychology. She teaches the rationalists, the ancient Greeks. She's also a well-known prize-winning author. And if we read all the prizes she's won, we wouldn't have time to talk with her today. Her first book, The Mind-Body Problem, her first novel, was published by Random House, became a critical popular success. The Dark Sister, another book. Properties of Light, a novel of love, betrayal, and quantum physics. Strange Attractors, which is a book of short stories. Incompleteness, it's a book about Kurt Gödel. Betraying Spinoza, the renegade Jew who gave us modernity. And we talked with Rebecca 2 or 3 years ago about her book, 36 Arguments for the Existence of God, a work of fiction. She became a MacArthur Fellow in 1996, receiving what is called the Genius Award. She's a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, and
Was honored us by accepting the Free Thought Heroine Award at our 2011 convention, where, welcome to our show, Rebecca. You gave just a wonderful, riveting speech about growing up in an Orthodox Jewish home as a young feminist.
Oh, yes, hi. It's so great to talk to you again, and I remember that. You were surprised to find out about my background. It's not something that I generally make public, that I was, born into a very Orthodox Jewish family.
Well, it seems like you might have another book there.
Yeah, well, maybe. I mean, it's motivated, I think, my entire life. All of, the passions that I pursued, that I came from there. So in one way or another, it's definitely fed my ambition. You know, I don't know that I'll ever actually write autobiographically about it. That's just I'm not terribly comfortable with that form. But it's fed into everything.
Well, I think our next guest, Margaret Marshall, was right to compare you to Margaret Fuller, because like Margaret Fuller, who said she really wanted to make something of herself, you found a way to fight out of that box and become a leading thinker, a philosopher, and an author. And so I think there are some great parallels there. But this current book you have, Plato at the Googleplex, it's a very colorful kind of fun cover, Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. And I've read most of the book, and it's really an interesting approach that you made, kind of a time travel thing, as if Plato himself came back alive in the 21st century. So tell us why and how you got the idea, and what's the thrust of the new book?
Well, what is the thrust of the book? One of the things that I have always wondered, many people have wondered, is why did the Greeks make such tremendous leaps? Why did they introduce such fundamental ways of thinking? The roots of science begin in the ancient Greek world, and of philosophy as well. In fact, they were indistinguishable from each other back then. And they really begin secular thinking. That the roots it's simultaneous, it's contemporaneous with the roots of the major religions that still exist now, the Abrahamic religion and, Zoroastrianism, Confucianism, Taoism, Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism. What have I left out? I don't know, but they all are emerging in roughly the same period.
And a few centuries later than Christianity, just about three or four
centuries.
But
the Abrahamic religion is in full force there, and Christianity and Islam are extensions of this.
Yeah.
And so it is of that kind of monotheism. So, you know, great existential thinking is going on in this period. But the Greeks pursued it in a secular way. And of course, I argue that this is the only way that's actually made progress. So one of the things I was actually trying to do in the book was to explain the emergence of what it was about the Greeks that made them think in a secular, rational way about the same big existential questions, you know, what does it all mean? How do I live a life worth living? That were being thought about religiously at the same time, but also to say that we've made a lot of progress with this. So when I bring Plato back, and I bring him back with these dialogues, and that's the way he wrote in dialogues, so that I have interspersed through the book dialogues, when I bring him back, he is constantly being amazed by the progress we've made, not just scientifically, and in our technology, but philosophically and ethically. There are things that we all know, like that slavery is wrong, that he never even considered. I argue that progress has been made, not through religion, but through this rational, secular thinking, enough so that the man who started it is shocked.
Well, and also I think in your book you point out Plato got a lot wrong, but what was his significance is he was the first to ask the questions. Is that right?
Yes, exactly. He asked the questions, and he developed this form of self-critical thinking, and that's the most important thing, you know, that when you think you've got the final truth, think again. I think that's one of the reasons he wrote in dialogue form, that it's always, there's always something tentative about our conclusions. It's always open to further refutation. And that's exactly what's happened, that's the way philosophy makes progress.
Well, there's a great chapter in there. I have to confess, I jumped ahead to the one about Plato on the talk show host, which it's hilarious. And you don't name who this talk show host is, but he's a popular conservative talk show host who talks about the tides coming in and the tides going out. And so he's talking with Plato, and this line that jumped out at me, he says, well, Plato, you're kind of wishy-washy. You're willing to change your mind. Maybe you just don't have the courage of your convictions. And Plato says, I would prefer the courage of my questions.
Yeah, I think that's probably, I'm glad you brought that out. That was, you know, if I had to pick one line that summarizes the book, that's it.
The courage of our questions.
Now, the courage of our questions.
Before we talk about this whole, the secular and morality without religion, can you explain the title, Plato at the Googleplex?
Right. So, actually, that is the title of one of the dialogues. There are five dialogues. And the first place I bring Plato is to the Googleplex, which is the headquarters of Google International, and they have, it's in Mountain View, California, and they have authors at Google where they bring writers in to speak to the Googlers, and I had gone there with my last novel and was, you know, very intrigued by these new sort of, I don't know, the technological elite, and I thought it would be interesting to bring Plato there first. So the first dialogue is the Googleplex, and he gets into a dialogue with his media escort, a very practical woman who would seem not to have any interest or patience for philosophy, but actually blows Plato away with the things she knows, and a software engineer who proposes to Plato that all of the questions that he asked, in particular ethical questions, can be crowdsourced, that you could build a search engine similar to the search engine that Google uses to answer these questions. And Plato, you know, it's kind of, I think it's a fairly sophisticated argument that the software engineer proposes, but Plato is able to dismantle it. One of the things I took tremendous joy in was that I interweave actual things that Plato said, you know, in his dialogues. He wrote 26 dialogues, and we have them all. And just weave them in, and if I didn't footnote it, you wouldn't know. It just sounds so relevant.
Contemporary.
And you do footnote where those come from, and we can look those up. We have to take a break, Rebecca, but when we come back, tell our listeners what was the first word that Plato typed into the Google with the first time he went onto the Internet. We're talking with Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, the author, the philosopher. Her new book is called Plato at the Googleplex, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And stay tuned for more Free Thought Radio.
Ask for a sample issue of Free Thought today and find out more about the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And we're continuing our talk with Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein, whose new book is called Plato at the Googleplex. I guess that's from the Google complex, where Google headquarters are. A book about philosophy, about the Greeks, about morality, about science. And before the break, Rebecca, you were telling us that in your story, your, I guess, science fiction story, Plato comes into the 21st century and goes to the Googleplex and for the very first time sits down at this computer of the World Wide Web Internet with all this information. Tell us what happens.
So, yes, he's very intrigued by this. And, of course, he's very intrigued by the cloud, which is a very Platonic idea, really. And you know, he's told that he can just type in a word and he will get information. And the first word that he types in is Socrates. And this is an important running theme in my book, and trying to get closer to Plato. Plato's such a man of mystery. You know, he wrote in these dialogue forms, and he let us get close to many of his contemporaries, including Socrates, who is almost always present in the dialogues. Often he's carrying the conversation forward. Sometimes he's not. He's only absent in the very last of the dialogues, the Laws, written when Plato is a very old man. But we don't really learn about Plato himself from these dialogues. He's hidden in much the way that Shakespeare is hidden in his plays. And so I really wanted to get closer to this man, this extraordinary man who raised every philosophical question almost, you know, or the fundamental ones, I should say, there. And one of the things that I think that we can learn about Plato is he truly loved Socrates. He came back to philosophy and wrote philosophy only after Socrates had been executed by the Athenians for the capital crimes of impiety and corrupting the young. And making Socrates a major figure in all of these dialogues was, I think, a way of bringing Socrates forward into time with the development of Plato's own independent thinking, making Socrates a part of it.
It was a very early bromance, as they say, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly, exactly. It was a truly passionate love, and love itself is a very important theme in Plato. He's very torn by it. He's very conflicted by it, and he changes his mind about that as he changes his mind about so many things. So one of the dialogues that I present is called XXX Plato, and it's Plato being consulted by an advice columnist about all sorts of problems. And I'm not just making this stuff up. When Plato gives his advice about should you sleep with your professor and this sort of thing, there are actual sources in Plato. I can tie it down to the text.
Wow. Now, what about, he was not an atheist. And what about this whole idea of morality without religion? And is this a question, is morality a question for science or philosophy or both?
What his beliefs were, who knows, about religion. He definitely thought it was a good thing for the masses. Plato did not have a high opinion of the masses. He was an elitist. He thought that the questions he was raising were very, very difficult, as they are, and that for the rest of the people who can't think well, there should be state religion, pretty much. That's what he says in the laws. And so, one of the things I really want to teach Plato when he comes back here is we're actually capable of a lot more. The mass of us are capable of a lot more than he gave us credit for. But I think, in terms of philosophers, the notion of goodness doesn't at all depend on God. In fact, one of the best argument that is used over and over again by free thought thinkers from Spinoza to Bertrand Russell to Sam Harris, sometimes they give Plato credit and sometimes they don't, comes from the Euthyphro, in which he has a knockdown argument that morality cannot be founded on religion. It's the best argument that's ever been produced, and it just keeps being reproduced by free thinkers. So whatever Plato thought about the gods, he really thought that morality was independent and that philosophy was a way of answering these questions, as indeed it is.
The Euthyphro dilemma comes up a lot then. Now, I read, I'm sure you've read some of these too, and I'm not going to name any names, but some very prominent scientists, including some Nobel Prize-winning scientists, who say philosophy is dead and science answers all the questions. We don't need the placeholder of philosophy anymore. We have about a minute left, Rebecca. What do you say? Is philosophy dead or is philosophy progressing?
Philosophy is progressing, and one fast thing I could say is that in making this argument about science, that science is the best way to understand the natural world, which I believe it is, they are using philosophy. They are using the criterion of demarcation between scientific descriptions and other descriptions. Who proposed this? Karl Popper, what was his profession? Philosophy. They are making the claim that science, even the most theoretical science that talks about unobservable things, that science is descriptive of reality. How can they make this claim? They have to turn to philosophers who argue for scientific realism. So even in making out their claim for the ontological superiority of science, that it's the best way we have of describing reality, they can't make that claim without relying on the work of philosophers.
Well, we thank you so much. I have just been speaking with Rebecca Neuberger-Goldstein, author of Plato at the Googleplex. It's a great new book, beautiful book, playful, Why Philosophy Won't Go Away, Random House. And you did speak at Googleplex, did you not, on this?
I did, and it was so much fun.
I bet. And we'll be coming up with Megan Marshall, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning biographer, a friend of Rebecca's, right? Who has the new bio out on Margaret Fuller. So stay tuned to Free Thought Radio.
The things that you're liable to read in the Bible, it ain't necessarily so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor.
And as we said earlier, we have on the phone with us from the Boston area, Megan Marshall, who's the author of the book, Margaret Fuller, A New American Life, which just last month won the Pulitzer Prize for biography. And before the show, we were talking with Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein about her new book about Plato. And Rebecca says, well, she's my good friend. And in fact, on the back of Megan Marshall's book, there is a blurb by Rebecca Neuberger Goldstein saying, Megan Marshall's brilliant Margaret Fuller brings us as close as we are ever likely to get to this astonishing creature. She rushes out at us from her 19th century, always several steps ahead, inspiring, heartbreaking, magnificent.
And Megan Marshall has written on American history, literature, women's history. Her first bio in 2006 is The Peabody Sisters, Three Women Who Ignited American Romanticism. This is her second bio, Margaret Fuller, A New American Life. And Megan will be the Gilder Lehrman Fellow at the Dorothy and Lewis B. Kallman Center for Scholars and Writers of the New York Public Library, 2014-2015, and she's received many, many fellowships and awards, and we're so glad to have you on the program, Megan Marshall.
Yeah, thanks so much for inviting me. It's been just a stunning experience, this Pulitzer Prize. I looked into the history of it, and I found that in almost 100 years, there have been only five biographies of women written by women to win the prize, including mine. So
wow.
It's a great honor and good for Margaret Fuller.
Yeah, good for you. And boy, that is really male-dominated.
Can I say my joke now?
Yeah, go for it.
Megan Marshall's book about Margaret Fuller gives us a fuller view of this fascinating woman's life.
You may have heard that.
Well, you know... I have, and it was a joke that she sometimes made herself. She spoke of that we should all achieve a fullness of being, and I think she was somewhat aware of the, sound similarity between that. But that was her main argument, and since we're on the topic of free thinking, she was, I think, not just a free thinker, but a free actor, which really sets her apart from the other transcendentalists with whom she was allied initially. She joined their group in Concord in Boston in the 1830s as really the primary woman free thinker, along with Emerson, who was one of her best friends. He called her the greatest conversationalist in America, and Thoreau, who she edited when she was the editor of the Dial. But she left New England, went to New York City to write as the front page columnist for Horace Greeley's New York Tribune.
And now she wasn't she the first woman war correspondent, the first full-time?
Yes, and that came a little later. First, she was in New York writing about prisons and mental asylums and all kinds of the plight of the poor. She was an investigative journalist in the early days of that. And then she talked Greeley into sending her overseas, where she landed in Europe in 1848 during the era of revolutions. And there she was, first American war correspondent, and first female war correspondent, landing in Italy, where she also had a kind of a flamboyant but secret love affair with a younger soldier in the Roman Guard, and had his child, their child, and in secret in a hill town outside of Rome, all the while covering this revolution in Rome and the rise of the first new republic. which unfortunately fell. And then, as you know, we were talking about this just before we started the show, that she reached a sad end at only age 40, coming back with her then husband and son to America after the fall of the Roman Republic in a tragic shipwreck just 300 yards offshore at Fire Island in 1850. So she accomplished an enormous amount in just 40 years, including also writing the first great feminist work, feminist book in America called Woman in the 19th Century. And it was just, you know, so forward-looking. Her notions of gender are very much, you know, 21st century ones. She said things like, there's no wholly masculine man, no purely feminine woman. All these characteristics just run, you know, amongst each other, between each other, in our souls, in our fullness of being.
Fullness of being. There you go, Ken. Now, before we talk a little bit more about who she is, I wanted to say, well, I edited an anthology of women freethinkers, women without superstition, no gods, no masters, and concentrated heavily on the women of the 1800s, including Margaret Fuller, who I first became acquainted with because one of FFRF members and a very good feminist activist, octogenarian activist here in Madison, Wisconsin, is Margaret Fuller's great-grandniece, Connie Trinan. And so Connie is the one who turned me on to Margaret Fuller. But when I was reading, and I did not do any kind of research like you did, but as I was reading bios and about the life histories of so many of these free thought heroines, you know, like Frances Wright and Margaret Fuller, I thought that if I was to write a novel about their lives, nobody would believe it. They're so outsized and so extraordinary. And don't you have that impression with Margaret Fuller? Who would believe this life unless it was a bio?
Yeah, certainly. You know, it's true. And I think that one of the things that's so astounding about her and perhaps some of these other women was that they were willing to own up to their ambitiousness. She, you know, at age 15, she wrote to one of her teachers, "I am determined on distinction." And she just drove herself until she got that. I mean, it was a time when, you know, not just women, but men were meant to be kind of modest about their ambitiousness, but she really went for it. And, you know, it's fascinating there. She had six younger siblings. Five of them were brothers. And so there are quite a few descendants of the brothers that I have met in the course of my travels and talking about Fuller. And Buckminster Fuller was one of her relations, as I'm sure you know. And so it's really very inspiring how, you know, I think many of these descendants take Margaret Fuller, including Buckminster Fuller, take Margaret Fuller as a model and a heroine to these days, as I think we all can do.
Well, I know Connie has a portrait of her hanging in her living room, and it was inspirational to her feminism. But when we want to put her in her place in history, do you want to talk a little bit about what was going on in Boston and the Transcendental movement?
Yeah, you know, the Transcendentalist era, the 1830s and 40s, that's when, you know, a group of Unitarian ministers, men, decided they'd had enough with the established church. Even the Unitarians weren't far enough out for them, and Ralph Waldo Emerson was a leader of this group. He decided as a minister he'd had enough with serving communion and abiding by a set creed. And really, actually, this is exciting. When I was writing about the Peabody sisters, part of this group as well, I found journals that Elizabeth Peabody had kept while staying with Emerson, and she went with him to one of the last sermons he preached. Well, he was still being a supply or substitute minister in the Concord area. And he told her afterwards, you know, "Did you see those young men in the back? They were, you know, nodding off and shifting their feet. Those are the men I want to reach. That's the audience I want to reach, not the people sitting in the front pew. And I'm never going to reach them in a church." He decided to go on to the lecture circuit and spread his gospel of self-reliance. And Margaret Fuller, you know, was his equal, every bit his equal. And in some ways, in this era when the ministers were turning against the establishment and Harvard was suddenly, you know, considered a conservative and, you know, not a helpful educational institution, this was a time when women who were not allowed to go to college anyway could have a bit of equality with men. And Margaret Fuller really claimed that. But what she brought to this was not just, you know, her own excitement about a kind of self-reliance. She called it self-dependence. One should be able to depend on oneself. But also a sense of the constraints on women's lives that I think Waldo Emerson and Thoreau would not really have taken up as an issue. But they made her, and she asked to be the first editor of the Dial, which could have been just a, you know, a bunch of ministers blathering on about what was wrong with the Unitarian Church. But she got women writers for this publication, women she had helped empower through a series of conversations she led for adult women to discuss Greek myths and the models they would provide for a more liberated way of living for women. And she was very interested in the arts as well, and so there's music and literature and art criticism in the Dial. And then her great front page essay called The Great Lawsuit, Man versus Men, Woman versus Women. She was very early on to this notion that social roles constrain both men and women. And so she phrased it as a lawsuit, interestingly. Her father had been a lawyer and a politician, and so I think that affected her choice of how to phrase this great debate, what she saw as the great radical dualism. Everybody tended to think that male and female were radically different, but in fact, she said, they're passing into one another at all times, which I think was a fascinating notion for anyone to have then, and it's still one we can look to today.
Now, she also was... What about the conversations?
Yes, the conversations. This was her idea. She had been... She had a fairly well-to-do upbringing. Her father had, as I said, was a lawyer and a politician, but he died when she was 25 and left her in charge of these six younger siblings. So she began teaching, teaching girls and young adult women, and trying out these ideas on them. But that began to frustrate her too. So she had the idea of gathering together adult women for whom there had been no opportunity to go to college. They hadn't had a classical education such as she had had with her father, who was determined to educate her as if she had been a boy, and to teach her the way to argue definitively, to be a disputant, as a lawyer must be. So she had these great skills, as Emerson said, in conversation, and she wanted other women to have this too. This was in 1839 and 40. She led these conversations about every week for 4 years' time. They were for women of the Transcendentalist Circle and other people passing through, such as Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was there for about a year in Boston. So these were very influential on the later women's movement. And they were asking themselves, what were we born to do? What should women do with their lives, not just study and discuss, but actually what should they do? And I think this led to the kind of activism that we see coming from Elizabeth Cady Stanton and others, who took a great inspiration from the book that she wrote based on that Dial essay, The Great Lawsuit. She called it Woman in the 19th Century. And that's where she, you know, it was a book that sold out instantly and was published in England and really made her an international influence.
Well, and I guess everybody compares it a little bit to Mary Wollstonecraft's A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, like an update.
It's an update, and then it also looks ahead to Simone de Beauvoir, The Second Sex. I mean, I think there's really nothing so radical as Woman in the 19th Century until you get to the middle of the 20th century.
We have to take a break, Megan. Sorry. We'll come back and continue our conversation with Megan Marshall, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Margaret Fuller, A New American Life. I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we'll be back, and we'll talk more about Margaret Fuller's views on religion and, I think, maybe her tragic death.
As Mark Twain said, faith is believing what you know ain't so. This is Free Thought Radio.
I'm Dan Barker.
I'm Annie Laurie Gaylor, and we're delighted to have on the phone with us from Boston, appropriately, Megan Marshall, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of Margaret Fuller, A New American Life. And we've been talking about this heroine from the 19th century, feminist and transcendentalist. And Megan, what were Margaret Fuller's views on religion?
Well, she believed that there was a creative force that drove all of us, but she didn't see it as a male or even particularly a female God above us, although she wrote wonderful sort of mystical allegories about female power, which she located in nature. One of the things she said, and, you know, she was part of this group of disaffected ministers, and they were always talking about, you know, the miracles and the issues of the Bible, but she had had enough of that. She said, you know, my church is here in my heart, and I think she felt each of us had a kind of calling to develop ourselves, our potentials, and you'd almost see her as part of what we began to call the human potential movement, I think, in the 1970s and 80s. She was really for us doing here on Earth what we were capable of doing, and that was it, which, you know, makes her own life so both tragic and thrilling, the fact that it was such a short life and that she gave so much to the world during it.
And during the break, you had mentioned, you know, her first book was, I think, Summer on the Lakes, published in 1844.
Yeah.
And she did some observing of the missionary harm to Native Americans, didn't she?
Yes. Yeah. This was her first great journey outside of New England, and she was traveling with some friends who had siblings who had settled out in Chicago, and they went by way of Niagara Falls and traveled by steamboat to, she spent about several months in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Illinois, and she was just appalled by what she saw happening to the Native Americans, and she said seeing them, she had expected to look at the great monarch trees of the West, and instead she found the Native Americans being forced to chop them down, their own natural surroundings, and feed to glut the steamboat that was bringing these hordes of immigrants from elsewhere to settle on the Indian lands. And she thought that was just terrible, which was a big motivation for her in writing this book. She wanted to tell this story. And when she went specifically to Mackinac Island to witness a gathering of the tribes to receive what little funds they were given in exchange for giving their land, and found that so tragic. But she wasn't just kind of standing there watching. She actually, you know, walked among the Indians. She kneeled down and ground corn with them. She showed them how her parasol worked. They were curious about that. And so she really was someone, you know, unlike, as I said, Waldo Emerson, as he was called, and who would write about these things when pushed to it by often the women in his family. But she really took it upon herself to investigate and see what was happening and then report it to the world at large through her books and through writing for the New York Tribune, which, interestingly, was not just a daily newspaper in New York City. Horace Greeley had the brilliant idea of circulating every week a national edition. So she had over 50,000 readers for the work that she was doing, and really gained a national and then an international reputation once she went abroad. So, you know, when she died in 1850, she was probably the most famous American woman.
Yeah, and a household name, and so few people know her today.
Margaret Fuller. Remember that now.
Yeah. Now, I remember...
Learn about her.
One of her credos, anyway, give me truth, cheat me by no illusion. And that seems very powerful. But I think we only have a minute or so left, but can you recap her very tragic death?
Yes. Well, you know, she had hoped that the revolution would succeed in Italy, and of course it did later, 20 years later. There was a unified and free Italy, but it didn't go that way, and so she needed to come back to earn a living. She had her now husband, Giovanni Assoli, who was 10 years younger, and they were on a cargo ship rather than the Cunard line because they didn't have the money for that, and then the captain died of smallpox, and so it was only the first mate running the boat, and he, you know, didn't know where they were in the middle of the storm and thought they were south of New York Harbor. Instead, they were off Fire Island, where there's just terrible shoals and unfortunately scavengers on the shore who had no interest in trying to help rescue these people out on the ship.
And she had her baby.
Ran aground.
Right?
And the baby, yes. Yes, she had her baby, the two-year-old son now, and Giovanni. And, you know, some of the people made it to shore. Some of the sailors dove in and swam. But Margaret Fuller and had seen these people on shore, not realizing they were scavengers, thinking they would be rescued.
Yes, so tragic.
Waited and waited, and the tide came in, and yes, they were swept out to sea, and neither Margaret nor Giovanni's bodies were ever found, although the little boy floated to shore and was buried by the sailors in a trunk in the sands.
Oh, so sad. This is now 1850, and she was only 40?
She was 40 years old, yeah.
But her life...
Emerson said...
Go ahead.
Yeah, Emerson said, I have lost in her my audience. He was stricken and sent Thoreau down to look for the manuscript of the book she'd been writing on the Italian Revolution. It's just... You know, a great story that could be a movie.
Yes, it could. A 40-year-old woman, and it's almost 400 words. And a wonderful book. Thank you so much, Megan Marshall, for writing Margaret Fuller and joining us today.
Thank you, Dave McCann, for engineering producing our show today, which is produced in Madison, Wisconsin. Go to ffrf.org/news/radio to learn all you want to know about Free Thought Radio.
Ask for a sample of our May issue, a free copy of Free Thought Today. If you want to learn more about FFRF, go to ffrf.org or phone 1-800-335-4021 or join us online and support our broadcast, our litigation, and our educational work. Tune in next week for more rational radio and blasphemous broadcasting.
Free Thought Radio is a production of the Freedom From Religion Foundation, FFRF.org. Irreverent views, news, music, and interviews brought to you by Annie Laurie Gaylor and Dan Barker. I hope